from KQED. Hey everyone, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Guy Marzorati, in this week for Scott Schaefer. And today on The Breakdown, we're going to take a trip outside of California's borders.
That's right. We are thrilled to have with us, all the way from the Peach State, the Democrat just elected to fill John Lewis's seat in Congress. State Senator Nikema Williams is also head of the Democratic Party of Georgia, so she knows a thing or two about organizing.
That's right. We're going to talk with her about how Democrats have been working for years to turn that state blue and what's ahead in two pivotal U.S. Senate races that will likely determine the balance of power in the upper chamber.
But first, Guy, as we've been saying for weeks, this election was not going to be settled on Election Day, and we were right. We have been following all these outstanding races, including several congressional seats that Democrats were successful in flipping to blue in 2018 and are still on razor's edge. What are you watching most closely right now?
Well, I think we're all watching what's happening in Orange County. Just really interesting set of results so far there. We've seen two Republicans on track to flip congressional seats there, Michelle Steele and Young Kim, while at the same time, two Democrats flipping state legislative seats. So I think it's you know, very interesting to parse through the results. Orange County, of course, was the home of the blue wave in 2018, a lot of resentment against President Trump. And I know kind of you've been looking into the numbers and talking to party folks in that county. It's just been fascinating to see, I think, a result that not many of us expected, Republicans gaining back seats in this election.
Yeah, although I feel like we're having all these conversations, and our guest, we can talk to her about this, about like whether Democrats did as well as they were, you know, we all thought they were going to. I mean, let's be clear. These were some of these stretch districts for Democrats. They were very close races even in 2018. And, you know, the results aren't in on all of them. I mean, definitely Harley Ruta did concede this week in the Huntington Beach seat to Michelle Steele. And so we know that, and we're watching that Gilsis Narrows. But for example, up further north in L.A. and Ventura counties, you know, Mike Garcia had won that special election to fill out Katie Hill's term. Christy Smith looks in a good position there. And yeah, I mean, I think Orange County, I mean, the reporting I did this week, Guy, was about how, you know, Democrats celebrated very heartily after 2016. Hillary Clinton flipped the county for the first time since 1936, a Democrat won. They did very well in 2018. But what it's really turned into is a battleground place, right? This is a truly purple county now. And I think that I talked to the heads of both the California parties, Republican and Democrat. For once, they agreed on something. They were like, this is going to be hard work for us moving forward, no matter whether you're Republican or Democrat. And I think it just speaks to the changing demographics, but also the fact that, you know, we, as much as a lot of America is in these very divided places, there are still these pockets of purple.
Right. And I think, look, big picture, as you say, the long-term trend is the congressional map in California is trending blue, right? There are seats that we talked about 5-10 years ago as battlegrounds. I'm thinking about the city of San Diego, suburbs of Sacramento, Coachella Valley, Palm Springs, that now those seats are off the map. You know, Raul Ruiz, Ami Barra, Scott Peters, they're safe. They're all kind of off the grid in terms of battle districts. Yet Orange County, as you know, when you talk to the heads of the both parties, they're really digging in for kind of entrenched political warfare for the next few election cycles. And I'm curious, and I don't know if you got this talking to Rusty Hicks, the head of the state Democratic Party, but like, what's the long-term play for Democrats if Donald Trump is not kind of in the picture as a foil?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we didn't talk about that specifically. I will say that, you know, looking at, say, Congressional District 50, which is the one that Duncan Hunter had to resign after being indicted, or actually, yeah, he did resign, right, eventually. Mm-hmm. but, you know, this is the Democrat who had challenged him, Amar Kampanajar, went up again against Daryl Issa, formerly the richest man in Congress. And I think the Republicans have like a 10-point advantage in that district, right? Kampanajar is within a few points. I mean, maybe it's closer to 4 to 5 now, but it's way closer than Democrats would have expected even a few years ago. And I do think that, you know, talking to Rusty Hicks, the Democratic chair, about that, he's saying, you know, to have somebody like Kampanajar with that name in that district, which was historically so white and Republican, is a good sign for them. But, you know, as we've seen nationally, you got to keep working for it. You can't mm-hmm. just pack your bags and go home after the election. And I think that that's going to be the real question. What is the organizing going to look like in these places in the 2 years before the next congressional races? And can either party get a leg up by really, you know, staying present and focused?
Yeah, I think that's going to be something to watch there. Again, we are looking at still some outstanding congressional seats in the state. Mike Garcia, seat north of Los Angeles, and then that seat in the Central Valley with TJ Cox. There's been kind of a delay in the vote counting as there was a COVID outbreak at some elections office there in one of the counties in that district. So I think, you know, more results to come. But it's looking like we're going to getting some clarity, you know, getting some resolution before Thanksgiving. I think that's all we could ask for, Marisa.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, before we turn to our guest, I do want to ask you, Guy, you've been looking into how voting went in California. And I think nationally, I mean, it's fair to say that we had a lot of concerns about this election playing out, whether it was foreign interference, you know, kind of online misinformation, just whether people would actually be able to get there and cast votes. It went pretty well, right? I mean, are we going to take away, I don't know, are we ever going to go back to regular sort of voting in the future?
I don't think so. I think this election and the success in administering this election in California really is going to set kind of a blueprint for how voting takes place in the state going forward. I think the success you saw of Californians embracing vote by mail and early voting at such large levels, look, we're looking at 16 million votes in this election, three quarters of which were cast before Election Day. So just a huge buy-in on that end, I think is going to forever change how voting takes place. I think counties are going to move towards those kind of early voting. I think you're likely to see permanently every voter get mailed a ballot before the election. And because we're political junkies and we can't help but looking at this through an electoral lens, I think this is a feather in the cap for Alex Padilla, right? The Secretary of State. This was a big challenge making all these changes in a short timetable during the pandemic, and the state and local election officials pulled this off.
I mean, and really what a difference from the primary when we had so many problems in places like Los Angeles, and a lot of people are looking at, by, you know, Padilla with kind of a side eye going,
right,
you know, what's, and now he's on the very short list, well, or long list, depending. But I think he's at the top of the short list of folks that people think could end up being tapped to fill Kamala Harris's seat, our vice president elect, of course, from, you know, one of two senators from California, both women. So it'll be interesting to see. All right, we are going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll be joined by Nikema Williams. She is Congresswoman-elect for Georgia's 5th District. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
I'm John Glenn Hill, host of The Weeds. And I know that politics can feel like a joke, and not always in the ha-ha funny way. On The Weeds, we try to split the difference.
When you think run out of money, you think that we're going to get to a point where, like, one guy retires and Social Security is like, sorry, y'all, got to board up.
Like, that's it. Sorry, he got the last check.
I always call him Jim. Like, Jim got it. Sorry, y'all. He got the last check, and that's all the checks we got, and Social Security is no more.
Check out The Weeds every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa, here today with Guy Marzorati. And our guest today, well, she's got a lot of titles. She is Georgia State Senator Nikema Williams. She just won election to John Lewis's congressional seat. She's also the head of the Georgia Democratic Party. Congresswoman-elect, we'll go with that one. Welcome to the breakdown.
Thank you.
We so appreciate you taking some time. You are in D.C. for freshman orientation, which we thought they might have moved back a few weeks after last time when someone showed up and then lost their race from California. I don't know if you know that story.
Oh, ouch.
She's still in the photo.
So, as I mentioned, you just won John Lewis's seat. I mean, a civil rights icon. And you both grew up in rural Alabama, not far from Georgia. What did you hear about him growing up? And I just have to ask, like, could you ever have imagined that you would be filling his seat in Congress one day?
So I remember reading all about the civil rights movement growing up in Alabama. It's like when the rest of the country is learning about, like, U.S. history, we learn about our Alabama history is U.S. history. And so my aunt integrated the University of Alabama. And so I always had, like, that civil rights history in my family, but never did I imagine that I could move to Atlanta not knowing a soul when I moved here after college, and then be able to build the relationships, do the work in my community, and succeed someone like Congressman John Lewis in Congress. Y'all, I grew up in a home in rural Alabama with no indoor plumbing and no running water. So when I say this is beyond my ancestors' wildest dreams, it is truly never something that I imagined.
I just got chills. That's really amazing.
And you mentioned your great aunt, but I think your grandfather was also politically involved. I mean, was this something you followed growing up? Were there political conversations in your household? And what is your family saying now that you are now going to be a member of Congress?
So I sat here in my hotel room. I was raised by my grandparents in Smith Station, Alabama, the big city. And so my grandpa, he would have slate cards that we would take around to our neighbors so that they knew who to vote for. But I was just excited to be the kid because I could ride on the back of my grandpa's pickup truck and I got to jump off the back and leave him on the doors. Little did I know that that was political activism. Had no clue at the time. But now sitting here today would have been my grandma's birthday, my grandma who raised me. And I was just looking in this room and I have all of this new member stuff laying here. My grandparents had a fifth grade and eighth grade education respectively. And never did I imagine that like everything that they instilled in me was preparing me for this day. And to be here for my first day of new member orientation on my grandma's birthday, just, I mean, I was in tears. I text my sister and I was like, y'all, I can't stop crying. And she said, who did it? I'm my way. I'm about to get on an airplane. But I was like, no, it's just tears of joy. I am just thrilled, but I know that I have an obligation to live up to this legacy that was left for me. There is so much work to be done because I have to open doors for so many other little Nakimas who were born in situations that they deserve an opportunity to progress out of. So I know that I grew up in abject poverty, but that did not limit what I was able to do in this country. And as a Black woman in politics right now, I am making sure that I open this door wide open for so many other Black women to come behind me.
Well, I mean, you came to Atlanta, as you said, you didn't know anyone there. I think this was after college. You got involved with the Young Democrats there, and you ended up working for Planned Parenthood for a decade. I'm curious, like, what that work, huh?
10 years.
Yeah, 10 years, yeah. I mean, what did that work kind of lay the groundwork for when you got involved more directly in politics? I mean, not that I think everything to do with Planned Parenthood is political, but is there sort of an organizing side that you can, you know, because this is what we've seen in Georgia is just the power of on-the-ground community organizing.
Oh, absolutely. I would not know nearly what I know now had it not been for my time at Planned Parenthood and how to organize and how to base build and how to make sure that you have deep conversations about issues that matter most to people. And so I took all of those skills with me when I went on the campaign trail. I only left Planned Parenthood 3 years ago when I ran for the state Senate. So just in 2017. And so I took all of those organizing skills, all of the policy skills, and that's honestly one of the reasons that I ran. I've been working at the state capitals across the Southeast for so long, and I was like, I'm just as smart as these people down here making the laws, and some of them I'm smarter than. So why not me when the seat came available? Why I am the best person to advocate for my community. And so I took a chance and left my paid job to run for state Senate and stepped out on faith. And here I am 3 years later here at new member orientation in Congress.
And as a state senator in Atlanta, I'm sure you shared a lot of constituents with the late John Lewis when he was in Congress. You also, you know, your husband worked with him. I'm sure you knew him on a much more personal level. Can you share just kind of what he taught you on that kind of basic person-to-person political level? Obviously, he was a national civil rights icon, but just lessons you learned with, from him personally.
I think one of the biggest takeaways from Congressman Lewis, outside of just the political piece, because so many people got to experience that, but Congressman Lewis always showed up for his people. Never forget the personal aspect of politics. And I'll never forget the day that I was sworn into the state Senate. I don't remember actually inviting Congressman Lewis, which is kind of bad now that I think about it. But he was so busy and he had so many other things to do. And y'all, he showed up at the state capitol that day for my swearing in on a random day in December when I was sworn in after winning a special election. He came straight from the airport because he wasn't in town. And he left before we finished that day, headed right back to the airport because he was supposed to be in DC doing the people's work, but he did not want to miss me being sworn in. And so I have a picture of him sitting on the front row that day with me and my husband and my son standing in front of the state Senate chamber and Congressman Lewis looking on with pride. And that just showed me like it, and that means so much to me. And he was always there for his people. So that is like one of the biggest takeaways, always be there and show up for people.
Yeah. You also have something in common with our vice president-elect. I noticed you are an Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority member. I know the sisters of that sorority showed up big for Kamala Harris during this campaign. I guess I just want to know, like, what is it like seeing somebody who's part of that group ascend to, you know, this even new level for her? And also, do you think that that's not maybe not coincidental that you took some leadership lessons from that fellowship as well?
No, on Saturday when the news came in that it was finally official that she was going to be the next vice president, I was frantically searching social media for an AKA meetup in Atlanta that we could all go and celebrate. And then when I didn't find one at 2 o'clock, I was like, fine, I'm planning it myself. And so at 2:08, I remember I started texting a few friends a graphic of meet me at the John Lewis Hero Mural at 4:08 p.m. We were founded in 1908, so I wanted to start at 4:08 so that everyone knew that it was an AKA event. And we all met up there in our pink and green, and we sung our national hymn because the words in that hymn just mean so much to our sisterhood. And we were founded in 1908 for college-educated women because we weren't allowed to, number one, attend mainstream institutions, and founded at an HBCU, which I'm an HBCU graduate, Talladega College in Alabama. And just, I mean, just the fact that the first sorority has now produced the first Black vice president in this country, the first Black sorority, means everything to us. And so get ready for inauguration, because we are going to paint this town pink and green. You're going to hear us doing all of our sorority calls, lots of ski-weeing going on throughout the city. But we're excited, we're proud, we're thrilled, and we know that there are more ladies of Alpha Kappa Alpha coming behind her.
We definitely want to ask you about your time as the head of Georgia's Democratic Party, the kind of amazing transformation we've seen in that state in recent years as it's shifted to now a presidential battleground that looks to be going blue in the 2020 presidential election. I think a lot of national focus first started in 2018, Stacey Abrams' run for governor. There was a lot of criticism over the way that then Secretary of State Brian Kemp and some voter suppression tactics. I'm just curious, you know, in the last couple of years, as we've gone from that defeat to the potential victory in 2020, what were the biggest changes that happened? Were there changes to the way in which electoral law happened, or was it kind of Democrats overcoming some of those tactics?
It was all of the above. So, like, if you start back, this is, we've always been very clear that this was never about one election cycle, and this was never about one person in office. And so anyone who makes this about Donald Trump, they're giving him way too much credit, and Georgia Democrats are not paying him that much attention. Trust me. So this was about giving power back to the voters in our state, giving power back to Black voters in our state who for far too long have been silenced in our political process because of our voter suppression tactics that Republicans have put in place. So while we saw this on the national stage in 2018, I remember becoming the interim vice chair in 2013, the summer that Shelby V. Holder was overturned. And my very first interview as becoming interim chair in June of 2013 was around the Voting Rights Act being overturned by the Supreme Court. And so we have been toiling here in Georgia, organizing, doing deep organizing. Stacey Abrams brought our work to scale and helped us with the national resources and attention so that the rest of the country could finally catch up to what we knew was possible in Georgia.
Can we talk some specifics here? I mean, we know that this year, for example, reading about what happened in Georgia, that, you know, voter precincts were moved and that, you know, there's been a series of different laws and policies that have helped, you know, especially hurt, I think, Black people in Georgia specifically, but nationally, right? Brown and Black people access their right to vote. Are there specific laws that y'all in Georgia are really looking at there, or do we need a national law? Like, what still needs to change from a policy and legislative perspective to make sure that people are enfranchised? Which, so I just have to say, like, shouldn't be a partisan issue, right? Like,
it absolutely should not. And I think it's kind of playing out right now when you hear Republicans, depending on what state they are and what the shift is in the voting numbers, are saying count every vote. And I'm like, oh, what a novel idea.
I think you have a t-shirt that says count every vote.
Right. So, and I think back to just 2 years ago in 2018, actually, it'll be 2 years ago tomorrow, when I was literally arrested in the state capitol for demanding that every vote be counted in the aftermath of the 2018 governor's election. And so now fast forward this year, and you have some Republicans saying this, and they want to recount, and we're going through all of this. But that is one of the reasons that I am so excited about coming to the United States Congress, because something like voting should be standardized across the country. It should not matter which state we live in if I have access to vote safely during a pandemic. My right to vote by mail shouldn't decide on if a random secretary of state or a local county election officials decide to mail me a ballot. That should be standardized across the board. And so things like same-day voter registration, things like absentee ballot access broadly for everyone, those are things that we still need to get behind and we need to do on a national level.
You mentioned your arrest. This happened after the 2018 Georgia gubernatorial race protest at the state capitol. Kind of just take us through that moment and how that changed your perspective. At that point, I think you had yet to take office, but kind of how that changed your perspective on the issue, seeing so many people mobilized around the issue of voting, which often gets overlooked in terms of electoral politics.
No, well, actually, I was already in the state Senate, which is what made my arrest even worse, because I was in session that day and I was literally exempt from arrest by our state constitution and they took my butt to jail anyway. So thinking back on that, I never planned to be arrested. I showed up to discuss Hurricane Michael relief in the state. And I saw some of my constituents downstairs in the rotunda of the Capitol demanding that every vote be counted in a protest. And I went down thinking that I could protect them, because I know that police do not treat people that look like me and the same as people that don't look like me, Black people specifically. And so I went down thinking that I could bring some calmness to the situation and never imagining that I would be in zip ties and taken out of the state capitol and taken to jail. A lot of people that day thought that I planned this and that I wanted to be arrested. And y'all, I wanted to be going to pick up my son that evening from preschool and going home and coming back the next day for session. But I ended up spending 7 hours in the Fulton County Jail, where they asked me to take my clothes off so that they could strip search me. I learned a lot about the criminal justice system. I learned that if police want to arrest you, if they want to find a way to silence your protest, that it doesn't matter how peaceful you are. If they don't like what you're saying and what you're doing, they will still find a way to take you to jail. And so that's why I will always stand on the side of people speaking up for what is fair, just, and right. Because no matter what you are saying, you have a right to voice your concerns to your government. And so I told my Republican friends that day, that the next day in the chamber, that today it was me and the next day it could be them. And so I implored them to stand with me, and none of them did. None of them. And now look at them 2 years later.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Guy Marzorati, and today we're talking Georgia with Congresswoman-elect Nikema Williams. You know, you mentioned before that this election wasn't about Trump for Georgians, and you guys have some very impressive registration statistics. I think 1 million new registered voters since 2016. That's an increase of 22% of voters under the age of 35. I know we're still counting votes, but like, what's your sense about what that translated to in terms of people power? Are younger voters coming out? Did you see a real change in, you know, the electorate, not just in terms of Democrat versus Republican, but just what it actually looks like?
No, absolutely. All of this comes into play. So Georgia, now we have motor voter registration. When you get your driver's license renewed or move to the state and get a new license, it's an opt-out, not an opt-in. So we have more people on the voting rolls. And you said since 2016, but since 2018 alone has been 800,000 of those since 2018. And we look at those numbers combined with the intersections of just the work that's been happening on the ground and that real investments that happened this year. And we have the perfect storm. And that is why Joe Biden is now up by 14,000 votes in the state of Georgia. And I fully expect that to be reaffirmed whenever this hand recount is finished.
When you talk about that kind of grassroots organizing, we've seen similar things in Arizona helping flip that state. And it's a lot of local groups doing the work, not in election years, not in the weeks right before Election Day. So with that being said, what's the role of the National Democratic Party? If you were tapped to lead the DNC tomorrow, what would you be doing to better coordinate and support those kind of local efforts?
Uh-oh, you're going to have my phone ringing off the hook. She wants to be DNC chair. Y'all about to get me in trouble over here. I mean, I really think that I say all the time, democracy doesn't start and stop on election day. This has to be a year-round effort. I made a commitment when I became chair of the Democratic Party of Georgia. I'm the first Black woman to ever chair our state Democratic Party. And I made a commitment that we would organize year-round. My grandma taught me, if you stay ready, you'll be ready. And in order to be ready, we have to have the investments. We have to have the national support to make sure that we have organizers on the ground having conversations with voters and keeping this going on a year-round basis.
So let's talk about the elephant in the room, the Georgia Senate runoffs. There's been so much attention paid to your state prior to this election, but I think the entire nation is going to be watching, as we approach January 5th, as these two seats are up that really look to be determining the balance of power in the U.S. Senate. So, you know, Democrats have struggled in a lot of places to get folks to the polls when it's not an election year. What's the plan? How optimistic are you? What needs to happen between now and January 5th, or maybe even sooner if people are voting by mail still?
So I will say that, yeah, Democrats have struggled to get voters to the polls historically, especially here in the South. But we are breaking norms this year. People also did not expect us to turn blue, but we believed. People also said that we shouldn't be electing this Black woman as state party chair in Georgia, but here I sit. And so we are shattering norms in the state this election cycle, because if we do what we've always done, then we would not be up by 14,000 votes for Joe Biden right now. We are continuing to make sure that we have a massive vote by mail program, because we know that everyone should be able to vote safely during a global pandemic. And we're continuing to organize on the ground. We've already hit the ground running, and we have two U.S. Senate seats with great candidates in Raphael Warnock and Jon Ossoff. So we're doing the work on the ground. Can't reveal too much. Don't know how many people are tuning in, because you know those Republicans in our state are going to do everything in their power to try and stop us. But we know how much is at stake. We know that the balance of the United States Senate is at stake. And we're going to do everything that we can to bring home democracy right here in Georgia.
And you've said Georgia is now the center of the political universe, likely for the next month or so. Is that good or bad for Democrats?
Oh, it is absolutely great for us. I've had so many people reaching out wanting to know how they could help, even young people in the state who didn't vote in November, on November 3rd, because they were like, well, Georgia's going to be red anyway. And who really didn't believe. Now that we're getting so much media attention, so many people paying attention and seeing that winning is possible in Georgia, it really is a mind thing. You have to be able to believe it to achieve it. And so now we have people that actually believe what we've been saying all along. And so I welcome the help. I welcome the support. People can go to georgiademocrat.org and help us out here. And we're looking forward to delivering on January 5th.
Yeah, I mean, I want to ask, because there's a lot of people listening here in California and people across the nation of both parties who want to be a part of this. What are you telling them is helpful at this moment?
So we have an out-of-state volunteer program. We have an in-state volunteer program. We need your time, your talent, and your treasure. We have people who can, if you can come to Georgia, we welcome you. If you're going to be at home, we have work for you to do as well. And you can sign up all of these opportunities at georgiademocrat.org.
All right, Nikema Williams, Congresswoman-elect of Georgia's 5th Congressional District, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank y'all.
That's it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We are a production of KQED Public Radio.
I'm Guy Marzorati. You can follow me on Twitter at Guy Marzorati.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me at M Lagos. Thanks for listening.
Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.